Chapter 21. Directly on stepping outside Omer's hut, Abdullah caught sight of Willems. He expected, of course, to see a white man, but not that white man, whom he knew so well. Everybody who traded in the islands, and who had any dealings with Hudig, knew Willems. For the last 2 years of his stay in Makassar, the confidential clerk had been managing all the local trade of the house under a very slight supervision only on the part of the master. So everybody knew Willems, Abdullah amongst others, but he was ignorant of Willems' disgrace. As a matter of fact, the thing had been kept very quiet, so quiet that a good many people in Makassar were expecting Willems' return there, supposing him to be absent on some confidential mission. Abdullah, in his surprise, hesitated on the threshold. He had prepared himself to see some seaman, some old officer of Lingard's. A common man, perhaps difficult to deal with, but still no match for him. Instead, he saw himself confronted by an individual whose reputation for sagacity in business was well known to him. How did he get here, and why? Abdullah, recovering from his surprise, advanced in a dignified manner towards the fire, keeping his eyes fixed steadily on Willems. When within 2 paces from Willems, he stopped and lifted his right hand in grave salutation. Willems nodded slightly, and spoke after a while. "We know each other, too, in Abdullah," he said, with an assumption of easy indifference. "We have traded together," answered Abdullah, solemnly, "but it was far from here." "And we may trade here also," said Willems. "The place does not matter. It is the open mind and the true heart that are required in business." "Very true. My heart is as open as my mind. I will tell you why I am here. What need is there? In leaving home one learns life. You travel. Traveling is victory. You shall return with much wisdom." "I shall never return," interrupted Willems. "Have done with my people. I am a man without brothers. Injustice destroys fidelity." Abdullah expressed his surprise by elevating his eyebrows. At the same time, he made a vague gesture with his arm that could be taken as an equivalent of an approving and conciliating "usso." Till then, the Arab had not taken any notice of Asa, who stood by the fire, but now she spoke in the interval of silence following Willem's declaration. In a voice that was much deadened by her wrappings, she addressed Abdullah in a few words of greeting, calling him a kinsman. Abdullah glanced at her swiftly for a second, and then, with perfect good breeding, fixed his eyes on the ground. She put out towards him her hand, covered with a corner of her face veil, and he took it, pressed it twice, and dropping it turned towards Willems. She looked at the two men searchingly, then backed away, and seemed to melt suddenly into the night. "I know what you came for, Tuan Abdullah," said Willems. "I have been told by that man there." He nodded towards Babalatchi, then went on slowly, "It will be a difficult thing." "Allah makes everything easy," interjected Babalatchi, piously, from a distance. The two men turned quickly, and stood looking at him thoughtfully, as if in deep consideration of the truth of that proposition. Under their sustained gaze, Babalatchi experienced an unwonted feeling of shyness, and dared not approach nearer. At last Willems moved slightly, Abdullah followed readily, and they both walked down the courtyard, their voices dying away in the darkness. Soon they were heard returning, and the voices grew distinct as their forms came out of the gloom. By the fire they wheeled again, and Babalatchi caught a few words. Willems was saying, "I have been at sea with him many years when young. I have used my knowledge to observe the way into the river when coming in, this time." Abdullah assented in general terms. "In the variety of knowledge there is safety," he said, and then they passed out of earshot. Babalatchi ran to the tree, and took up his position in the solid blackness under its branches, leaning against the trunk. There he was about midway between the fire and the other limit of the two men's walk. They passed him close. Abdullah slim, very straight, his head high, and his hands hanging before him, and twisting mechanically the string of beads, Willems, tall, broad, looking bigger and stronger in contrast to the slight white figure by the side of which he strolled carelessly, taking one step to the others too, his big arms in constant motion as he gesticulated vehemently, bending forward to look Abdullah in the face. They passed and repassed close to Babalichai some half a dozen times, and, whenever they were between him and the fire, he could see them plain enough. Sometimes they would stop short, Willems speaking emphatically, Abdullah listening with rigid attention. Then, when the other had ceased, bending his head slightly, as if consenting to some demand, or admitting some statement. Now and then Babalichai caught a word here and there, a fragment of a sentence, a loud exclamation. Impelled by curiosity, he crept to the very edge of the black shadow under the tree. They were nearing him, and he heard Willem say, "You will pay that money, as soon as I come on board. That I must have." He could not catch Abdullah's reply. When they went past again, Willem was saying, "My life is in your hand anyway. The boat that brings me on board your ship shall take the money to Omar. You must have it ready in a sealed bag." Again they were out of hearing, but instead of coming back they stopped by the fire facing each other. Willems moved his arm, shook his hand on high talking all the time, then brought it down jerkily, stamped his foot. A short period of immobility ensued. Babalichai, gazing intently, saw Abdullah's lips move almost imperceptibly. Suddenly Willems seized the Arab's passive hand and shook it. Babalichai drew a long breath of relieved suspense. The conference was over. All well, apparently. He ventured now to approach the two men, who saw him, and waited in silence. Willems had retired within himself already, and wore a look of grim indifference. Abdullah moved away a step or two. Babalichai looked at him inquisitively. "I go now," said Abdullah, "and shall wait for you outside the river, two and Willems, till the second sunset. You have only one word, I know." "Only one word," repeated Willems. Abdullah and Babalichai walked together down the enclosure, leaving the white man alone by the fire. The two Arabs who had come with Abdullah preceded them, and passed at once through the little gate into the light, and the murmur of voices of the principal courtyard, but Babalichai and Abdullah stopped on this side of it. Abdullah said, "It is well. We have spoken of many things. He consents." "When?" asked Babalichai, eagerly. "On the second day from this. I have promised everything. I mean to keep much. Your hand is always open, O most generous amongst believers. You will not forget your servant who called you here. Have I not spoken the truth? As he has made roast meat of his heart." With a horizontal sweep of his arm, Abdullah seemed to push away that last statement, and said slowly, with much meaning, "He must be perfectly safe. Do you understand? Perfectly safe, as if he was amongst his own people till..." "Till when?" whispered Babalichai. "Till I speak," said Abdullah. "As to Omar." He hesitated for a moment, then went on very low, "He is very old." "Hiya." "Old and sick," murmured Babalichai, with sudden melancholy. "He wanted me to kill that white man. He begged me to have him killed at once," said Abdullah, contemptuously, moving again towards the gate. "He is impatient, like those who feel death near them," exclaimed Babalichai, apologetically. "Marshaled well with me," went on Abdullah, "when..." "But no matter. Remember, the white man must be safe." "He lives in your shadow," answered Babalichai, solemnly. "Tea is enough." He touched his forehead, and fell back to let Abdullah go first. And now they are back in the courtyard where from, at their appearance, listlessness vanishes, and all the faces become alert and interested once more. Lakamba approaches his guest, but looks at Babalichai, who reassures him by a confident nod. Lakamba clumsily attempts a smile, and looking, with natural and ineradicable sulkiness, from under his eyebrows at the man whom he wants to honor, asks whether he would condescend to visit the place of sitting down and take food. Or perhaps he would prefer to give himself up to repose. the house is, and what is in it, and those many men that stand afar watching the interview are his. Said Abdullah presses his host's hand to his breast, and informs him in a confidential murmur that his habits are ascetic, and his temperament inclines to melancholy. No rest, no food, no use whatever for those many men who are his. Said Abdullah is impatient to be gone. Lakamba is sorrowful but polite, in his hesitating, gloomy way. Two and Abdullah must have fresh boatmen, and many, to shorten the dark and fatiguing road. Hiya! There! Boats! By the riverside indistinct forms leap into a noisy and disorderly activity. There are cries, orders, banter, abuse. Torches blaze sending out much more smoke than light, and in their red glare Babalichai comes up to say that the boats are ready. Through that lurid glare Said Abdullah, in his long white gown, seems to glide fantastically, like a dignified apparition attended by two inferior shades, and stands for a moment at the landing place to take leave of his host, and Ali whom he loves. Said Abdullah says so distinctly before embarking, and takes his seat in the middle of the canoe under a small canopy of blue calico stretched on four sticks. Before and behind Said Abdullah, the men squatting by the gunwales hold high the blades of their paddles in readiness for a dip, all together. Ready? Not yet. Hold on all. Said Abdullah speaks again, while Lakamba and Babalichai stand close on the bank to hear his words. His words are encouraging. Before the sun rises for the second time they shall meet, and Said Abdullah's ship shall float on the waters of this river at last. Lakamba and Babalichai have no doubt if Allah wills. They are in the hands of the compassionate. No doubt. And so is Said Abdullah, the great trader who does not know what the word failure means. And so is the white man, the smartest businessman in the islands, who is lying now by Omar's fire with his head on Asa's lap, while Said Abdullah flies down the muddy river with current, and paddles between the somber walls of the sleeping forest, on his way to the clear and open sea where the lord of the isles, formerly of Greenock, but condemned, sold, and registered now, as of Penang, waits for its owner, and swings erratically at anchor in the currents of the capricious tide, under the crumbling red cliffs of Tanjung Mura. For some time Lakamba, Sahaman, and Bahasan look silently into the humid darkness which had swallowed the big canoe that carried Abdullah and his unvarying good fortune. Then the two guests broke into a talk expressive of their joyful anticipations. The venerable Sahaman, as became his advanced age, found his delight in speculation as to the activities of a rather remote future. He would buy pros, he would send expeditions up the river, he would enlarge his trade, and, backed by Abdullah's capital, he would grow rich in a very few years. Very few. Meantime it would be a good thing to interview Almayer tomorrow, and, profiting by the last day of the hated man's prosperity, obtain some goods from him on credit. Sahaman thought it could be done by skillful wheedling. After all, that son of Satan was a fool, and the thing was worth doing, because the coming revolution would wipe all debts out. Sahaman did not mind imparting that idea to his companions, with much senile chuckling, while they strolled together from the riverside towards the residence. The bull-necked Lakamba, listening with pouted lips without the sign of a smile, without a gleam in his dull, bloodshot eyes, shuffled slowly across the courtyard between his two guests. But suddenly Bahasan broke in upon the old man's prattle with the generous enthusiasm of his youth. Trading was very good. But was the change that would make them happy effected yet? The white man should be despoiled with a strong hand. He grew excited, spoke very loud, and his further discourse, delivered with his hand on the hilt of his sword, dealt incoherently with the honorable topics of throat-cutting, fire-raising, and with the far-famed valor of his ancestors. Babalichai remained behind, alone with the greatness of his conceptions. The sagacious statesman of Sambre sent a scornful glance after his noble protector and his noble protector's friends, and then stood meditating about that future which to the others seemed so assured. Not so to Babalatchi, who paid the penalty of his wisdom by a vague sense of insecurity that kept sleep at arm's length from his tired body. When he thought at last of leaving the waterside, it was only to strike a path for himself, and to creep along the fences, avoiding the middle of the courtyard, where small fires glimmered and winked, as though the sinister darkness there had reflected the stars of the serene heaven. He slunk past the wicket gate of Omer's enclosure, and crept on patiently along the light bamboo palisade till he was stopped by the angle, where it joined the heavy stockade of Lakamba's private ground. Standing there, he could look over the fence, and see Omer's hut and the fire before its door. He could also see the shadow of two human beings sitting between him, and the red glow. A man and a woman. The sight seemed to inspire the careworn sage with a frivolous desire to sing. It could hardly be called a song. It was more in the nature of a recitative without any rhythm, delivered rapidly but distinctly in a croaking and unsteady voice. And if Babalatchi considered it a song, then it was a song with a purpose, and, perhaps for that reason, artistically defective. It had all the imperfections of unskillful improvisation and its subject was gruesome. It told a tale of shipwreck and of thirst, and of one brother killing another for the sake of a gourd of water. A repulsive story which might have had a purpose, but possessed no moral whatever. Yet it must have pleased Babalatchi, for he repeated it twice, the second time even in louder tones than at first, causing a Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.